first minister I really remember when I was a child was the Reverend Wesley A. Morris. I was about 5 years old, I think, when Wesley Morris came to Simpson Avenue United Church, my family church, to be our minister. And when we left there when I was 10, he had been the minister all the way through, and he had a great influence on me when I was a little child, because sitting in the gallery with my parents and looking down at a sea filled with adults worshiping, I knew it all had something to do with that person in the black robe at the front. And it was the beginning, I believe, of a call to ministry taking place in the heart of a little boy. Well, to my delight, many, 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 many years later, when Wesley Morris was in his 80s, and I hadn't seen him much over the years, he telephoned one day and said, "Malcolm, Lillian and I want to come down to Metropolitan in these last years of our life and throw in our oar with you." And down they came. And Wesley Morris was at more things at the church than I was. Whenever there was a study group, Wesley was in the middle of it. And out of the cold every Sunday, every Thursday, Wesley was in the middle of it. And he was a most remarkable and encouraging friend. So lovely to have that circle of life come round. And at one point, I remember him taking me to his house and into his library. And he said, "Why don't you take anything you would like from my library?" A very gracious gift. And I looked at them and I chose a few things. And this week, as I was looking through my notes upstairs for Sunday, I came across his set of the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, four wonderful books that I use regularly to read and to research. And inside the front cover, it says, "From the Library of Wesley A. Morris." It means a great deal to me. Well, this is what the article concluded with on the theme of Advent. Listen. "It may be assumed that the main line of Christian tradition will interpret Advent to mean, at least, that God will bring to perfect completion the work begun through Christ, and that the same Christ who stands at the center of Christian faith will also stand at the final boundary of human experience in time and space and in eternity." What a paradigm. It indicates that that little desert flower born so long ago in ancient Israel has something to do with the primal future and ultimate destiny of the human race. That is a huge, huge theme in the season we enter today, Advent. But one of the problems with having faith about something like that is that our relationship with God seems a bit hit and miss, doesn't it? A little bit hit and miss, if we're honest about it, that there's something missing, that we sense the great giftedness of human nature and the great possibilities of the world in which we live and the great themes that lift us to great heights, and yet they don't seem to come through. The idea of the God fills our sails, and yet we feel we're living much of the time in the doldrums. It's very hard to have faith when you feel like that. We even speculate about what God's promises being kept would look like. To many of us, it means peace. Ultimately, we feel there will be peace. I was listening to a CBC radio program the other day. Peter Mansbridge was the guest. And at the end of the program, somebody said, "What is the great word you hope for to mark the end of 2019? What's the word we'll be speaking about at the end of next year?" And immediately he said, "Peace. It's peace." He said, "The other word that comes to mind, just as important, is impeachment." Well, you understand that. We hope profoundly for peace. At the last, it's inside all of us, peace. Beyond the wars and beyond the civic corruption and beyond criminality and beyond dangers in the streets and weeping in the night, just a measure of peace. We know it's in there. We know it belongs to us. And yet the wars continue and the blockades of Ukrainian vessels by the Russians and the intrusion of American secret ops in South America and the war in Yemen and all the rest of it and the armaments continuing and the battles in the streets between the... all of it builds up, and we know that peace is what we desire. And it is not peace that we get, and it makes belief in God's promises, the coming of God, all the more difficult. And for some of us, it is a sense of deep belonging. Oh, please, may the promises of God include deep belonging. No haves and have-nots anymore, no entrapment, no persecution, no abuse. The music of the spheres and the rhythm of the cycles pouring through all our lives and encouraging us to sing a fuller, more joyful life. More joy than pain, we say. More playfulness than drudgery, we say. More inclusion than rejection, we say. Oh, look up and look around. Behold the wonders of the world. Behold it all. A sense of deep belonging. And yet everywhere there is nationalism and tribalism and ethnic difference and the class distinctions and the economic distinctions that ruin us every day. It's hard to believe in the coming promises of God. Jeremiah sensed the promise being kept in a persistent vision of great leadership. He said there is great leadership out there. We have a sense of what it will look like, even if we don't see it very often. Great leadership. Hold your loyalty to this great vision. It's greater than any single life, but sometimes someone measures up towards the heights of great leadership, and we're all refreshed by it. And he mentioned the figure of David, of course, King David, the great king of ancient Israel. Now, David was a man, and he was a broken man, and he was a man who made mistakes. He was a petulant man. He was a singer of songs. He was a breaker of hearts. He was an ordinary, regular man, but on occasion he rose to something more. And people saw on occasion the heights to which he rose, and they said deep in their hearts, there is leadership, and it looks something like this. There is a trustworthy center somewhere that is worthy of holding high. I was thinking of Dylan Thomas, the poet, the other day. I don't think much about Dylan Thomas, but I know he died in his 50s, that he was a raving alcoholic, that his marriage to Caitlin was rocky at the best, full of infidelity and anger and rage, not much of a leader, and yet it was Dylan Thomas who was able to write, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should rage against the close of day." A sense in there somewhere of the precious nature of life and the essential command to fight for it all the way, even into old age. He's on to something, a vision of leadership in this broken Welsh man. And he was the one who wrote, "And death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked, they shall be one with the man in the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean and the clean bones gone, they shall have scars at elbow and foot. Though they go mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink through the sea, they shall rise again. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion." Leadership, a deep sense of something that leads us all higher than we are. Keep your eye on that to sense the promise of God, said the prophet Jeremiah. A shade and a nurture of a righteous branch over us. One of the most irritating things of going for a walk at the cottage in the summer is you just get out on the road and one of those little black flies comes and buzzes around your head. You know the ones, they get in your hair and they won't leave you alone, and you run 50 meters and they've caught up with you somehow and they're still buzzing in your head. Do you remember that? Am I the only one that this happens? I wash my hair 3 times a day, the little bugs still find them. So I'll go across to the side of the road and I'll tear off a small leafy branch and I'll walk up the road waving it over my head, and the flies somehow go away. That shady green branch protects me from the things that bother me. Leadership. And this year for my birthday, I said to my grandchildren, "I want a set of those walking sticks that you see old people using when they go out walking for balance. And when I go to the cottage and walk up the kilometer-long road, I'm going to walk with my walking sticks." In case I meet a bear, I can stick it with the end. But I'll be walking up the road with my walking stick. So my 10-year-old granddaughter came in without ceremony and said, "Happy birthday, Grandpa, here's your walking sticks." So I'm going to take them to the cottage. And they're going to hold me up one side and the other as I walk up an unknown road, the gift of leadership at my side. What you need comes through intentional lives, lifting themselves to an ideal just beyond themselves, and we see it. No more them with the gun crimes and us with the righteous indignation, and no more them with the closed door deals and us with a sense of betrayal, and no more them climbing all over us going somewhere and we standing around going nowhere, seemingly. One people flowing beautifully in one city, alive to its worth, its potential, and its variety, focused in the vision of great leadership. That's how you see the promise of God, said Jeremiah. Well, who is your David? Who is your great leader in this vision, do you think? Perhaps we lose heart in the faithfulness of God's promises because our response to these promises is too small. Now, I need to be careful writing this. I'm not blaming anybody, and I'm not suggesting that our faith is unworthy or that our faith is little. I'm saying that it's really tough to keep focused on holy things in a world with so many heartbreaking distractions. So how thin or how thick is your connection? How thin or thick is your own prayer life, your own inner spiritual life? Does it consist of help me in mine and guard my perimeters and protect my heart, the heart of my little world? Is that the extent of it? That's a good prayer. Is that as far as it goes? What does it say about the rest of us and the rest of the world around us? Perhaps God is larger than that, and perhaps the true and deep God needs a greater response than that. I find prayer time, if I have a structured prayer time, more and more to be the most difficult time of the day. I go to bed about 10:30, and I crawl into bed, and I pull the covers over my head, and in the darkness I think, oh my God, it's prayer time. I have to say something to the God. And I start off with thank you for this and this and that, and then I say to myself, well, God already knows about that, so you put that aside. And then I say, these are the 19 things I want. And then I say, what is God, Walmart or something that I can win with my list? So I put that aside. And then I just say, God, you know me well. Help me to preach as well as I can to the end. Help me not to get in your way. Bless the congregation that I serve and the world you love. The rest is up to you. Amen. Not much of a prayer, but I feel in the darkness it is my requirement, it is my privilege, and it is my challenge to make some connection with the great God around me. Perhaps it is simple wakefulness to the world that is the greatest prayer we can ever give. Are you awake to the world, to its pain, its joy, to its differences, to your place in it? Perhaps I need to do 1,000,000 small things before I can ever address the power of the big things, the things that turn the world. People have more and more been asking, what are you going to do when you retire? Well, I don't know what I'm going to do when I retire, but I realize there isn't a whole lot that I know how to do. I can write a few things, but I have no one for whom to write them anymore, so it's going to be very interesting. So I thought to myself, perhaps I'd like to become a portrait artist. Yes, a portrait artist like Rembrandt. And then I realized I can only draw cartoons and stick figures all face on. I can't draw hands and elbows and feet. I can't draw details. I know a little bit about light and shade from art class in grade 13. But if I'm going to become a portrait artist, I'm going to have to do 1,000 small intentional things by which I learn to draw the shapes and the colors and the forms of the things I love. It's going to take some work on my part. And I do have a set of bagpipes. Aren't you glad to hear that? They're stored away in the basement. I've never played them. My wife has taken the lock and thrown away the key. We'll talk about that later. But at some point, I might say to myself, I'd love to play the bagpipes. Well, I've tried it once before, and I studied with a friend for a few weeks, and he said, just pick the notes up off the page and play them on the chanter. Well, that's a big space between the page and the chanter, and after a while, I just wanted to play what I liked, little tunes that I liked. and I kept running out of air on the way through. It's a lot harder than you think. So maybe I need to do 1,000 small things before I can march down the street with the pipe band playing Strides of Bonnie Dundee. 1,000 small things. How much time do we spend with God as learners of the mystery, offering a few small things by which to learn? Somebody needs to go deeper for us all and to run against the tide for us all. Someone has to risk the current wall of cynicism and relativism. Nothing matters is the common theme. Everybody's right and everybody's wrong is the common song. Someone needs to shout, surely the days are coming. Because if the days are not coming, nothing has any meaning anymore. Someone has to say, my eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, and stand there in the face of the ridicule and abuse which follows such a phrase. Beyond the parched earth, beyond the broken systems and the crying children and the stifling air, there is a river of promise, and it's running chest deep, and somebody has to say it. Midway through preparations for these remarks, I started to become restless about the word Advent. Advent, it means coming. But to me, it's got too much tinsel all over it. It's too Christmassy or something. There's something Christmas tree-ish about Advent. I needed a better word, and so I went to Wesley Morris's Dictionaries of the Bible, and the article on Advent very quickly threw me over to the word parousia. There's the word, a Greek word, parousia, much better word. The excitement of dreams becoming tangible and true right in front of you right now. And I thought of the end of the war and of 1,000 train stations in 1,000 homecomings, people, family members, wives and friends and parents waiting for the troop train arriving, and they know that on this very day their loved one, for whom they have wept and mourned, for whom they have feared, is coming just up the track, and when the doors open and the crowd pours out, their loved one will be among them. That's the feeling of parousia. It means presence, and it means arrival, and it also means coming at the same time. It is the deep, deep story of the children of Israel. The children of Israel knew parousia their whole life. They are slaves in Egypt, and parousia happens. The great God breaks in and sets them free. They are lost without leadership, and parousia happens. The great God comes and lifts up Moses and Aaron. They are wandering in the wilderness, and parousia comes, and the judges and the prophets and Joshua step forward to lead them. They are taken into exile, and parousia comes. A battle is won. Cyrus the Persian is called the Messiah, and he sets the people free, and on it goes. The intervention of the great God is the backbone of the story of ancient Israel. It's the day of the Lord. We're in it. We're surrounded by it. It's not behind us in history. It's not ahead of us in wishful thinking. It is not burning brightly in somebody else's backyard. It is in the story of Jesus, a great tale of parousia. Read the story of Jesus in the Gospels, and you will read of God breaking into our time and changing everything. A parable of parousia at the heart of our own faith. Jesus in the Gospels is made to say, if I, by the finger of God, cast out demons, then surely the kingdom of God is come. Parousia. It's coming. It's here. It's about arrival. St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians is the first and oldest text in the New Testament, and it underlines the fact that God's promises are always held within a community of faith. We model it together. We encourage each other to flesh out the meaning of God's promises. We need each other. We are witnesses to a shared thing. We've had our grandchildren come over recently, once a few weeks ago for my birthday, and everyone had dinner, and everybody wished everybody a happy birthday, and then yesterday to make gingerbread houses, and it's amazing how the family breaks down in terms of age. The children are all around one table, all with their cell phones out, talking about hormones and all the things that people between 8 and 14 talk about. And the adults are sitting at the other table, eating cheese, drinking wine, and talking about schedules and hockey games and all the things they have to do. And rarely do the two meet. But eventually they all come together, and it's so wonderful when we all sit around and laugh together and recognize our own flesh and blood and our own skin. And I felt very old having my young people all around me. And one of our little guys stepped forward with a gift and said, "Happy birthday, Grandpa. You're an old man, and this year is one step closer to death." He's the cheerful one in the family. But then he added, "Grandpa, you're so cool, you're going to live to be 200. I love that kid. He's back in the will. George MacLeod, the founder of the Iona community, wrote, "Invisible we see you, Christ, beneath us. With earthly eyes we see beneath us stones and dust and dross, fit subjects for the analyst's table. But with the eyes of faith, we know you uphold. In you all things consist and hang together. All is in flux, but turn a stone and an angel moves. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Unknowable, we know you, Christ, beneath us. Here is the confluence of the great river of promise with the current of our daily lives. Name your people, cherish the people you call family and beloved, dream among them, and trust them with your life. Together we carry the mystery of the river. We carry it in the energy of the morning. I taste the world then. And on the plateau of noon, I feel the heat in my life force then. And in the cloister of the afternoon, I rest in the momentum of God when I'm tired then. And in the gift of evening, I find darkness as a backdrop to eternal light then. And in the night of dreaming, I marvel that surely the Lord is in this place. The river of promise washing me from morning until night." Well, the great river of promise is filled with the commerce of warm friends, but it is also bespeaking turbulence and timing. This apocalyptic literature, which I read you from the Gospel of Luke, is difficult to understand, isn't it? It's frightening, isn't it? Why is it in the New Testament at all? Is the New Testament not to be a place of glory, a place of love and peace and rescue? Apocalyptic literature has been part of the biblical saga since the beginning. It's a way of poets and writers trying to discern how do you bridge the divide between the terrible brokenness of the world and the sensed glory of the great God? How do you bridge the gap? And the writers say some terrible cataclysm is going to occur when the true and beautiful world collides with the awful, corrupt, and disreputable world. There has to be a catastrophe in there somewhere. The turbulence will be overwhelming, and they write about it. And so it's true in New Testament thought as well. When the great God breaks in, it actually involves the breaking of something, the breaking of many, many things. When the river comes, it will destroy much of what we have valued, many of the things we hold on to. When the reign of God comes, the reign of other things will go. And that's going to be turbulent, and it's going to be full of pain. But the river flows. Creedence Clearwater writes, "If you go down to the river, bet you're going to find some people who live. You don't have to worry if you've got no money. People on the river are happy to give. Proud Mary, mother of Jesus perhaps, keep on burning. Proud Mary, keep on turning. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river." When the death of one child inspires the unlikely to challenge and defeat the immovable, then the days are surely coming. When a tentative faith and a sampling faith becomes the ravenous faith of a rebel, then surely the days are coming. When the river of promise overflows the banks of manicured convention and seekers flood across the land for the sake of a new life, then surely the days are coming. Alfred Lord Tennyson, as a young man, lost his dearest friend, Arthur Hallam. Arthur Hallam was 22 years old and died suddenly, broke Tennyson's heart. Tennyson wondered and worried if he'd ever see him again, if the promises of heaven were real, or he had lost his beloved friend forever. He sat down and wrote in a new form his poem, Ulysses. Ulysses. It speaks of the changing times in Victorian England, a sense of empire beginning to fade away, and the question, is there anything else in the middle of it, any river of promise to hold on to? It profits little that an idle king, by this still hearth among the barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed, and know not me. I cannot rest from travel, I will drink life to the lees. I am part of all that I've met, yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams the untraveled world, whose margins fade forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life, life piled on life were all too little, and one of me little remains, but every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things. And then he writes, come my friends, it is not too late to seek a newer world. Push off and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be that we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive and seek and find and not to yield, not to yield. All is in flux, writes George MacLeod. Turn but the stone and an angel moves. Underneath are the everlasting arms, Christ beneath us. We know you. The river of promise is flowing here. Yeah.